Here for the Lowe's early Black Friday deals? You're right on time for some of our biggest savings. We're talking up to 50% off select major appliances, plus up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. Holiday lights going up soon? Select ladders are up to 50% off right now. Get Black Friday prices without the Black Friday crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 11/19. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
As one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Leuten, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, the first King of England whose achievements rivaled that of William the Conqueror, the hidden history of lovers, lawbreakers and homemakers in the 19th century, mapping Ireland over the centuries and what they tell us about everything from colonisation to tourism, and to end the show, the most significant expansion of public galleries at the National Museum of Ireland in over 20 years. You can send us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. And we begin tonight's show with the first King of England. Æthelstan was the early medieval king whose territorial conquests and shrewd statesmanship united the peoples, languages and cultures that would come to be known as the Kingdom of the English. And a new book tells the story of England's founder king, whose achievements in 927 rivaled the Norman conquest of 1066 in shaping what became Britain. The book is called The First King of England: Æthelstan and the Birth of a Kingdom. It's published in hardback by Princeton University Press. The author is David Woodman. And David, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
We sometimes discuss anniversaries on this show, and sometimes they're centenaries, sometimes they're bicentenaries. This is the first time we've gone back for an anniversary that is 1,100 years old.
Yeah, it's an awfully long time ago. There are two key anniversaries that are on the horizon. I mean, one's just happened, in fact. So September represented the 1100th anniversary of the coronation of Æthelstan, which took place originally in Kingston-upon-Thames. And there were lots of very interesting celebrations taking place in Kingston, including the naming of a train, of all things, which was terrific to see. And then in a couple of years' time, in July 2027, that will represent the 1100th anniversary of the birth of England in the first place. I really hope we can get some more celebrations then.
So tell me about Æthelstan then. He was the grandson, I think, of Alfred the Great. He was the son of Edward the Elder. And how did he go about unifying these different kingdoms and creating, I suppose, an early kingdom of the English?
Absolutely. So he, as you say, he was born into the royal house of Wessex, son of Edward the Elder and grandson of Alfred the Great. And Alfred the Great had weathered, of course, many Viking attacks on the English kingdoms in various ways in the late 890s. And by the time that Æthelstan becomes king in 94, he very quickly expands his authority and remit further north. So the key event that happens is in 927 when he forms England for the first time. And he's able to do that because the then Viking king in York, a man called Sitrich, had died. And Æthelstan very quickly takes advantage of this, marches north, captures York and takes Northumbria for himself. And then he proceeds further north to a place called Eamont Bridge, which is just south of modern Penrith in the northwest. And he holds a major ceremony there where various other British kings agree to recognize his supremacy as the new king of the English.
And even though he was born into this distinguished line of kings, it wasn't really as straightforward a path as it might appear, because there were all these different twists and turns. He was the son of Edward, but not his father's queen. There was questions about the legitimacy then of him. And his early reign was challenged from various different sources.
Yeah, just as you say, Patrick, that's exactly right. So he was the eldest son of Edward and his first wife, Edwin. But Edward married on two subsequent occasions and had more children, more sons and daughters. And so quite early in his life, Athelstan was actually sent away from the heart of politics in Wessex, sent up to Mercia, where we think he was brought up by his aunt, a very interesting person in her own right, the Lady Ethelflaed of the Mercians. And so when he comes to the throne, actually, there's a degree of opposition from within Wessex initially. And we know that we think there were plots to have him blinded, neutralized politically. So he had a real task on his hands to sort of solidify his position as king in the first place.
So tell us then about this crucial year 927 and the anniversary coming up. You know, you make a very powerful case about how this date is underappreciated, how it really was pivotal in the creation of this unified kingdom. And yet it is completely overshadowed by 1066 and other dates.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I find it extraordinary. It's so interesting that we've focused so much on 1066, the sort of undoing of England, if you like, and we've completely forgotten about the very formation of England in the first place. And in 97, so this place, as I mentioned, called Aermont Bridge, it seems to have been a place of topographical significance. There were various nearby ancient sites, things like King Arthur's Round Table Henge, Maybrough Henge. There was a Roman fort there called Brocavum as well. So it looks like he was trying to borrow symbols of authority from the landscape when he was organizing it. And it was also in a border zone at that moment between the kingdoms of Northumbria and Cumbria and Strathclyde. So very significant in terms of symbolism. And actually what it represents is not just his military authority, so he was clearly expanding in a military sense and forcing himself on people, but also, I guess, a kind of coalition between various different kings. There were kings from Wales present that day, there was a king from Scotland and a ruler from Northumbria as well. So it's a fascinating moment, and you know how he brought these people together, the amount of negotiation that must have taken place to make it a success. It's really, really such an interesting moment in our history.
And then he was able to defend it successfully when it was challenged and went under attack. And I think it was 10 years later, there was a major battle where he was able to defeat a huge coalition which had gathered against him.
Yes, absolutely. So in 937, we get the famous Battle of Brunanburh. And I mean, I think that Athelstan had been so successful in expanding his territory and his authority that actually he caused resentment. So there were a number of people who rose up against him. There was a Viking called Olaf Guthrason who came over from Dublin. There was a major Viking stronghold, of course, in Dublin at the time. He joined forces with the then King of the Scots, Constantine II, and we think also with the King of Strathclyde and Cumbria, a man called Owen, and they rose up and tried to overthrow Athelstan. And the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, which is the sort of the main contemporary source for this period, it inserts this beautiful and wonderful heroic poem of about, I don't know, 75 to 80 lines length, talking about this poem, talking about what takes place. And it was clearly a huge, a major military encounter between these forces, so much so that many, many people were slaughtered. It seems to have been a very blood-filled occasion. The poet talks about corpses being left on the battlefield for scavenger birds, and Athelstan managed to win out. And other contemporary witnesses, they talk very clearly about the fact that England had been on the line that day, and if he'd lost, it would have been a major blow to England's formation.
Athelstan seems to have had a very clever European strategy, that he wasn't just insular, just looking at events at home. He was prepared to make these dynastic marriages involving his sisters and connecting with the wider political stage and making sure that his court became a centre of learning and diplomacy.
Yeah, it's an astonishing story, actually. Once he's established himself as King of the English, very quickly he looks even further afield, just as you say, Patrick. And I mentioned earlier that his father had married on two subsequent occasions, and that meant that he had a number of half-sisters whom he deployed into sort of political marriages with contemporary European rulers. So we see him marrying his sisters into places like the Royal House of West Francia, the Royal House of East Francia, and we think also the House of Burgundy as well. And what that meant was that he was very well placed to take advantage of the way that politics was unfolding there, which is a different story. And Absolutely. He was a major sponsor of learning as well. His court becomes a kind of hub of activity, hub of cultural achievement and advancement. We think it was in Athelstan's court that one of the very earliest interactions in England with the Indian game of chess took place. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing. And we see European scholars going there, swapping texts, talking about ideas. So yes, there's so much that he was doing.
And also bringing in all these new innovations when it came to governance and record keeping and the emphasis on law codes and justice and royal authority. So this was really very much the construction of a whole framework of government.
Absolutely. And you know, we very quickly think about this period as the so-called Dark Ages, which I guess suggests that it's lacking in records in various ways. But actually, from Athelstan's reign, we get a whole set of contemporary royal documents, including law codes, including things called royal diplomas, which are basically grants of land made by the king to various people. And from these, we can really see and really chart in quite a lot of detail the royal ambition that Athelstan was driving, the way in which his policies were working, the way in which he wanted to depict himself as king as well. He has these elaborate titles that he deploys in his royal documents. He calls himself the Rex Anglorum. It's the first time we get this genuine usage of the Latin title King of the English. And sometimes he even claims to be king of all Britain as well, the Rex Totius Britanniae. So yes, from the centre of government, we have an awful lot of detail, and we can see exactly how he was trying to sort of solidify his hold over the new kingdom that he'd created.
And David, do you think you'll succeed in making sure that these anniversaries are properly remembered and that Athelstan's role in the creation of modern England or this nation state is recognised? Or do you think you're maybe fighting a losing battle, that when ideas capture hold on the popular imagination and they think certain things are the significant dates and people and anniversaries, that it's sometimes very hard to shift that? So do you think this is a battle you can win?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and it's certainly not a battle I'm taking on my own. I mean, I think, it was really heartening to see in Kingston that there were literally hundreds of people there for the celebrations and the naming of the train. And I think there's a huge amount of interest that's taking place now for the early medieval period, brought to life by programs on the TV like The Last Kingdom. So I think there is a growing awareness of the interest of that period, of the difficulties, the complexities of it, and the way in which these different peoples within England came together in the first place. So I'm really hopeful that 2027 will be properly marked. And there's lots of ways that we could do that in terms of commemorative statues and commemorative events and things like that. So yes, I'm very hopeful about it.
And do you think perhaps his reputation suffered because of the fragmentation that occurred after his death?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, certainly there are a number of modern historians who sort of try to discredit Athelstan, if you like, that after 93, he dies in 939, and just as you say, Patrick, that the kingdom fragmented a bit at that point. So Olaf Guthfusson, the man that he had beaten at the Battle of Brunanburh, he comes back over from Dublin and succeeds in becoming king again in York. So that fragmentation, that means that people have said, well, you know, did he really manage it after all? But I think just because it broke down doesn't mean that, you know, we can't regard Athelstan as the first king of England. He was actually so ahead of his time, I think, that it would have been more surprising if it had endured once he died.
And the real enduring legacy, as you would see it, is it the fact that he has had the foundations laid for what comes later in terms of diplomacy and lawmaking and centralised government?
Exactly that. And you know, I think him as England's founding father. I mean, he's somebody who needs to be known as that pivotal figure. And I really hope that he gets that recognition.
Well, it's a wonderful new book. It's called The First King of England, Athelstan and the Birth of a Kingdom. It's published in hardback by Princeton University Press. The author is David Woodman. And David, thanks a million for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's RUBRIK.com.
Here for the Lowe's early Black Friday deals? You're right on time for some of our biggest savings. We're talking up to 50% off select major appliances, plus up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. Holiday lights going up soon? Select ladders are up to 50% off right now. Get Black Friday prices without the Black Friday crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 11/19. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Welcome back. We're talking history. A new book uncovers hidden histories of love, courage and defiance in the 18th century. From clandestine coffee houses to radical rural retreats, it reveals voices long erased from the record. The book is called Queer Georgians, A Hidden History of Lovers, Lawbreakers and Homemakers. It's published in hardback by Doubleday. The author is Anthony Delaney. And Anthony, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I love that subtitle because it's a hidden history of lovers, lawbreakers and homemakers. So maybe talk to me about that concept and the approach that you took in the book.
Yeah, the homemaking is quite an interesting part of it and potentially a surprise for people who are looking at gender nonconforming lives in the 18th century, because for so long we have been told that home and domesticity and the comforts and joys of home are not really part of the queer historical experience. But actually, once you dig down into that 18th century archive and you discover, as I did during the course of my PhD, the figure of the Cot Queen, who was a man who very much liked to make home for other and with other men, then that starts to open up a whole other question of, well, we were told this wasn't possible, this homemaking idea. We know about the law breaking, but we were told this domestic possibility didn't exist archivally. But yet here we are, and here's this figure that encapsulates it. And therefore, that kind of prompted me to go on a bit of a journey of discovery archivally and see what else I could uncover and see what else we had overlooked, either by, you know, just the sin of omission or more deliberately in some cases.
And what was the biggest thing that surprised you when you were carrying out your research?
How obvious a lot of this history was, how archivally present a lot of it is. And yet how much we have been told that this doesn't exist. So, for instance, even when I started my PhD, my supervisor, who is utterly incredible, said, of course, you will not be finding a queer community in the 18th century because it didn't exist. Just that very basic premise, not to mention any of the other subtleties that also come up. But without a shadow of a doubt, in black and white, throughout various archives up and down the UK and Ireland and in America as well, there is continuous reference to what we would understand as queer community today. There are men who are writing to one another to tell each other, you cannot go down that street, don't go to that area, it's too dangerous. And they are meeting together in houses or in public houses, and not just in public spaces. And there is this idea of shared identity and shared comfort and joy and love and camaraderie that really has been omitted when we talk about queer lives in the 18th century. You know, it's really important, I think, that we start to understand that this history doesn't begin with Oscar Wilde. It is a much, much longer spread of history and you know, appears wherever we study the history of humanity.
And there are some really powerful and wonderful stories in the book. Tell me about Margaret Clapp, who became known as Mother Clapp, and how she connects in with this story.
Yeah, so Margaret Clapp ran what is known as a Molly House in 18th century London. And we're talking about 1726 specifically when we meet her in the book. And a Molly House was a place that was well documented, that men who had sex with other men could go and meet men like themselves. But it wasn't just a site for sex. It was a site for community building. It was a site for fun and frivolity. We know that there are these identities that are forming there because we have ideas of maiden names, for instance. So at Molly Clapp's, at Mother Clapp's Molly House, we have, you know, Orange Deb, who is an orange seller in Covent Garden, or the Duchess of Camomile, who lived on Camomile Street. And Margaret Clapp oversees all this. She's a businesswoman, she's an entrepreneur, and she's an ally to these people who are often up against legal persecution. And she goes and she attests for their good character when this happens. However, there is a raid on her Molly House in February 1726, and this unravels that world that she has so diligently and skillfully built for herself. And she ends up on trial herself. She ends up in the stocks. interestingly, we don't know what happens to her in the end. We know after she faints three times when she's put in the stocks in Spitalfields in London, and then she disappears into history. It's my hope she goes on to do something utterly fabulous somewhere else. But she is a real trailblazer, a real feminist trailblazer. And she is a key part of the beginnings of this book.
Tell me about Eleanor and Sarah and how these two women, exiled from their families, came to inspire an entire generation of romantic poets.
So Eleanor and Sarah hold a kind of a special place in my heart in this book, because I'm a Kilkenny man and they are originally from Kilkenny too. They are better known as the Ladies of Llangollen, which is a small little village in Wales. But to me, they are the ladies from Kilkenny. That is my baseline for this. I'm reclaiming them for the Irish history pantheon. And Eleanor Butler is part of, she becomes Lady Eleanor Butler later in her life, and she is part of the Butler family in County Kilkenny, the Butlers of the castle. And Sarah Ponsonby is one of the Anglo-Irish ascendancy, and she has been orphaned, but she lives with the Fownes family, also in Kilkenny, in Woodstock, the ruins of which are still there today. And these two women form such an incredibly close and intimate bond that it really does unsettle their families. And they are again, you know, talk about these trailblazers like Margaret Clapp. These are another two set of trailblazers. They are determined to be together. They run away. They try to get to England, but they're caught by their families, and there's pistols drawn. There's dogs yapping. There's carriages screaming down the alleyways to try and get them before they can get on the boats. But eventually they do persuade their families that they need to be together. And I think need is a really appropriate word in this instance. And so they head off and they have this incredible life in Llangollen. But for me, I concentrate on their Irish history, on their Kilkenny history, and in a way on my own history, because I count them as my forebears, my ancestors. We're not related by blood, but this is the historical legacy that they have left in Kilkenny, again, where I'm from. And so they really are a pointer to us that these histories are so deep-seated in Ireland and across the world. And it's important that we recognise them. So again, that's why I want to reclaim them as the ladies from Kilkenny, not just the ladies of Llangollen, because all too easily they become part of that British history where we need to take greater ownership of them in Ireland, I think.
And you're not afraid of delving into more tricky or more controversial aspects or characters as well. And one of them is Anne Lister. And Anne Lister has become, I think, hugely famous and celebrated now because of the incredible portrayal by Sir Anne Jones in Gentleman Jack. And that was a hugely successful series. But the Anne Lister that you uncovered was maybe not quite as heroic as the portrayal on the programme.
No, I think the first wave of queer histories, of public queer histories, has very much been, let's find the gays in the past. And that, you know, that was an admirable exercise in itself. But I think we're at a point now where we can look at these histories again, nuance them a little bit, and talk about actually what the archive shows us. And in Anne Lister's case, it really does show somebody who is, you know, a Tory landowner who's obsessed with power and with money, and money she doesn't have. And one of the ways in which she hopes to get this money is, in her own words, taking a very rich wife. And Anne Walker is one of the people that comes through her life and someone she thinks she can exploit. And that is, I'm using that word very deliberately, in order to extract that money from her. And we see, you know, she courts Anne Walker, but in her diary, we have the account of her saying, this is a weak, stupid woman. She has a queer mind. She hates being around Anne Walker sometimes. And we see that she undertakes this route of kind of incarceration with Anne Walker, where she puts her under the care of what we would now understand as a psychiatrist, maybe, Dr. Steph Belcom. And she hides her away in York. But during that time, she makes her change her will. And she checks with Steph Belcom to say, you know, is she still okay to change her will in my favor? And Steph, yeah, there's no reason that she cannot change the will. And so to me, it becomes this exploitative history. And then when Anne Walker moves into Shibden Hall, she says that Anne Walker fancies herself, and I'm quoting here, under restraint, that she is under restraint in the household rather than, you know, having this lovely life together. So it's not necessarily the history that Gentleman Jack sold to us. There was no incredible wedding at Gudrun Gate Church in York that is so well depicted. And by the way, Gentleman Jack is a great show and I really enjoy it, but it's not history. It's a period drama. And the drama is key there. But in this book, I want to look at the history again. We have to meet these people where they are archivally, and we must work for them in order to tell their histories, as opposed to making them work for us and what we think we are looking for in the past. But it's really important and fruitful, I think, to acknowledge their histories.
You have a wonderful conclusion to the book, and what you argue and what you suggest very powerfully is that these identities weren't invented in the 20th and the 21st century by liberal elites, that these identities go back centuries, and that there are examples to be found throughout our past, and that we can't pretend or try and imagine that they didn't.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we need to do to a great extent is rid ourselves of this very modern bullishness that we think we've arrived at the right terminology for everything. So you can't, therefore, express a history of same-sex attraction before the invention of homosexuality in 1868, for instance. Or you can't talk about trans identities because they wouldn't have had this idea of transness as we understand it today. But that is, as we all know, not the case. This book is called Queer Georgians. And of course, nobody in the Georgian era called themselves queer. They wouldn't have identified as that. And people do sometimes ask me about that. How can you write this queer history about the 18th century when they wouldn't have identified themselves as queer? But nobody ever follows up and says, why did you write this book with Georgians in the title? Because they didn't call themselves Georgians either. But they didn't.
And that's
so
brilliant.
If you're applying that logic to the past, we use anachronisms as historians all the time. The Tudors didn't understand themselves as Tudors. That's not how they identified. And yet we use it all the time. Even the idea of the family in the 18th century doesn't exactly equate to how we would express our idea of families in the 21st century. So we use anachronisms all the time. And if we can, then we need to be able to apply them to this history too. And we need to get rid of this idea that we have found all the terminologies now, and if we have the right labels for everything, and if those labels don't appear in the past, then we can't talk about those histories in that way. That's very arrogant, and it's very 21st century. We identify experiences and patterns and whatever else in the archive, and we're able to tell those histories. So we cannot tongue-tie ourselves into not being able to share these types of histories just because the labeling systems change. So it was really important that I showed that these histories are legacies of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years. As long as there's been people, there's been what we would now understand as queer histories. So yeah, that was a kind of a central tenet of the book. And I find that personally, but I hope for queer people and people beyond the queer community, that that's an empowering thing. That you know, our roots run deep. And that's one of the main messages of this book.
Well, it's a brilliant new book. The book is called Queer Georgians, A Hidden History of Lovers, Lawbreakers and Homemakers. It's published in hardback by Doubleday. The author is the brilliant Anthony Delaney. And Anthony, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And we'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Lowe's knows that saving is always top of mind, especially this season. That's why we've picked some great deals for early Black Friday. Get free select DeWalt, Cobalt, or Craftsman tools when you buy a select battery or combo kit. More tools? Why not? Plus, we've got select pre-lit artificial Christmas trees starting at $59.98 because it's never too early to think Christmas. Get Black Friday prices without the crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. While supplies last, selection varies by location.
Welcome back, we're talking history. Maps allow us to see how the world is organized spatially and show us relationships which cannot be understood from simply reading a text. And a new book highlights a vast selection of maps that range across the centuries and cover every part of this island, shedding light on the history and development of Ireland. The book is called Ireland, Mapping the Island. It's published in hardback by Berlin Limited. The authors are Joseph Brady and Paul Ferguson. I'm very delighted to welcome back Joe Brady to the show tonight. Joe, you're very welcome.
Patrick, it's very good to be back. It's very good to see you.
It's a wonderful book, and what I love about it is that you take on so many different areas. It deals with conquest and colonization, the management of the landscape, natural resources. You've got tourism and transport in it. So it's really a way of showing how other people saw Ireland as well as how we saw Ireland.
It is, and it's also an opportunity to highlight the huge resource that maps are. Because one of the things we're quite passionate about is that you find maps as the background, often as the adjunct to text. And you know, historians such as yourself are great at telling the story of the islands and all the rest of it. But we feel that the maps don't always get the kind of treatment that they deserve. So this is a book. It's not a history of Ireland, but it is a celebration of the maps that have been produced, and it's an examination of kind of the stories that they tell. And as you say, there's quite a number of themes running through it. But if I was to sum them up in terms of two, it's about business and it's about conquest with a little bit of religion thrown in.
I love it. I love it. Business, conquest and a little bit of religion. Well, what about the changes that have taken place in these maps over the centuries, that sometimes one particular image might be presented a few centuries ago, but then we now have a completely different perspective or view of it?
Well, I suppose we take it for granted that we know the shape of things. Because, you know, if you want to look, you go to Google Earth and immediately you're presented with a view from a variety of heights, and you can then zoom back up and see the entire country. You couldn't do that until recently. You had to take it for granted that the shapes that were being shown to you on the ground, on the paper, were actually true and real. So the focus of this changes depending on what it is that you're trying to show and you're trying to do. So if we go back to the question of conquest, it's all about saying, here are the lands that are available, these are the ones we're taking, and these are the ones that we're giving to you. If it's about tourism in the 19th century, it's about, these are the things you're going to see. The railway line runs down here on the inside. You can go to the west or to the east and you'll see this and that. If it's about the railway commissioners in the 1830s, it's about, lads, don't build railways there. You're going to lose a ton of money. Instead, build them here along this. This is where the limestone is. We've got a nice blue line down here. That's where the money is. So each map tells its own story. Each map is produced to tell that story.
And it's interesting what you say about tourism, because is it true that maybe, in a sense, maps and mapping help make tourism possible, because it created these possibilities of how you could construct a holiday or a visit?
Well, if you look at the development of the concept of the idea of the tourist, you move from a point where people who are interested in the world outside their own locality had to read travel guides. So you have people wandering around the country, and they come back and they write their book and they include a few maps in it and they say, this is what you will see if you go there. And gradually, as the 19th century develops, as the middle classes start getting a bit more money, as the concept of holidays starts becoming real for people, and given a big fillip by Queen Victoria, who gave a degree of respectability to going to visit places when she did her first visit to Ireland in 1853, then, of course, you have to have a guide. And the one thing about the Victorians was they didn't like the idea of purely enjoying yourself on holidays. You had to work. And so the guide would give you the full panoply of what was there, and you needed maps. Because how else were you going to walk the 15 miles that the guide suggested that you might do before lunch without a good map? And it produced a huge industry in the production of maps. And in fact, most of the companies that we still have in their various incarnations owe that genesis to the beginning of tourism.
The map covers the entire island, and of course we see the changes then in terms of boundaries and divisions, and you get a great sense of the evolving history of this island as well.
You do, because it is about, as I said, it's one of those themes. It is about conquest. It is about learning about the country, because the country goes through a number of different phases of conquest. There's confiscation of land and there's redistribution of land. And for that, you need maps, because people are very careful about the land that they've been given or that they've taken. And so that is why, in fact, we have such a rich resource, particularly of the earlier period, particularly of the Tudor period and so on. We wouldn't otherwise have, because with all due respect to the island of Ireland, it wasn't really on anybody's major agenda to map. But if you are going to wander into Tyrone, you need a good map. As poor unfortunate Richard Bartlett discovered when he was doing mapping there in the early 1600s, he wandered too far into O'Donnell land and they quite literally took his head off.
So what about county lines and county divisions? How natural are they?
Well, they're not that natural in the sense what they they evolved rather than were thought about sensibly. It was a case of saying, here are Gaelic territories. We're going to include this one here. We're going to include that one there. And there was a gradual evolution. Yes, using natural boundaries where that made sense, but also using other kinds of boundaries in terms of saying on this side we've got people we like, on this side the people we don't. And the county boundaries, once they were developed, were quite fixed. I mean, it's only really in the 1890s that you get any significant attempt at the redefinition of the county boundaries to make them a little bit more rational down here. The Freeman's Journal at the time reckoned that there would be murder at the attempt to redefine the county boundaries, and they waited for that murder to develop. But it didn't, actually, surprisingly. It actually got away. But they're one of these things now which are so fixed in the psyche of the population that even though they may not have the same kind of legal definition they once had.
It is fascinating the way these maps tell us stories about power, stories about identity. And did your sense of Ireland across the centuries change when you looked at maps from these different parts of our history? And did you get a different sense of the story of Ireland?
Well, what we get is the sense in which the various parts of Ireland become known, and the degree to which that evolves over the years. There is an interesting set of maps that relates to the late 19th century, where you get the shape of Ireland being used to produce a caricature of the country. It was an activity which was very popular for about 30 or 40 years. And it's very interesting to see what other people think of us, the kinds of things which are used to identify Ireland. And they are pretty stereotypical. You know, you get somewhat simian-looking peasants with doudines, pigs, appearing here and there and so on and so forth. So you get that sense of the stereotypical view. You also, when you're looking at the way in which the map goes, the realization, I suppose, that the country only really becomes known to the wider audience of the state by the middle of the 19th century.
There are over 250 maps in the book, and I wonder, did you have fun selecting them with your co-author, Paul Ferguson, who's a very distinguished map librarian at Trinity College Dublin, or was there ever a dispute between you where one of you wanted something to go in and the other didn't?
Well, we're still talking to each other. But yeah, I mean, the question was always, which one will we leave out? See, the issue is, firstly, can you find a good copy of the map? Can you get permission to reproduce that map? And then will we put that in? And yes, there were what you might call animated discussions between us, to saying, no, that one will go in or not that. And a little bit of give and take here. And I've got a nice one over here, but I've got a nicer one. Yes.
I love that. Well, do you have a favourite one? Is there one that stands out to you as something that you think, you know, maps the island in a particularly interesting way?
Well, the ones that I find interesting, they're not probably the best maps, but these are the ones which were produced during the Second World War of Ireland by the various powers. So you have the United Kingdom government using the Ordnance Survey maps, which it already had. But then you had the Germans wondering how they were going to manage to invade the country, and getting hold of Ordnance Survey maps from a previous generation. And then you have the Soviet Union in the 1970s mapping the entire world and mapping Ireland at a variety of different scales. And I love the fact that the maps are out of date, so that when we are invaded, they will look for the railway lines that no longer exist to transport the troops, and it'll give us a bit of a chance. So those maps I find fascinating. The other ones which I just love are the early ones, because they're works of art. They are masterpieces of the engraver's art. And so if you go back to Mercator and Abraham Ortelius and so on, you get these beautifully drawn maps. And I love the idea that you have something in front of you which has survived for 400 years, 450 years. It's been through many hands. It's still there. You do get that sense of history.
You mentioned there about the railway lines and things that are maybe obsolete now, or they're no longer active. But what about mistakes in maps? What about times when people think genuinely that there's something there that isn't, and you have these wonderful errors and distortions?
I learned a long time ago that while maps are wonderful, you better not pin your colours on any particular map. Firstly, maps are often out of date. So, as I've said, things which no longer exist are still there. And map makers are very wary about putting dates on a map because you won't buy it. If you literally go into a shop today and take down a map, you look for a date, you won't get it because they have a long shelf life, perhaps too long. But also, map makers put things on that were going to happen. And this back to the railways. In fact, in the railway age, you would often get a map which showed a putative railway line, but no indication whatsoever that it was only in thought. And the idea was that this would encourage speculation along the way. And sometimes most of the maps, in fact, up to the beginning of the 19th century, contain errors. So it's only when you get to Daniel Beaufort in 1792 that you get a map which is planimetrically correct. In other words, everything is in correct position relative to everything else. Beaufort was great because he produced a text, a memoir of the map, and he tells us how he had to take Roscommon and stretch it this way and turn it that way and move this town relative to that in order to get the shape right. Up to that point, if you headed off with a compass across country, you mightn't have got to where you thought you were going. So there's all of that as well.
You mentioned about taking down a map from the shelf in the shop, but has that also become obsolete now because things have been digitised, because we have maps on our phone? If we want to chart a route, that's how we do it, whether by public transport or driving or walking. And is there a certain amount of sadness about that, that the age, the great golden age of maps, it's changed forever?
Yes, there is a degree of sadness about it, not only because the physical map is gone, but there's also the issue, which is maps are now dynamic, and so they change instantly. We were able to do this book only because somebody at some point put the effort into producing a document which was fixed. Unless people are keeping maps at different stages, that's not going to happen. But there is still the same thing. I don't know about you, but certainly me. There have been anguished debates between myself and my good wife as the GPS attempts to take us down a road which has got several half a metre of grass growing on it, and saying, where's the map? The physical map, so that you can actually take it out and look and see where the thing is. So there still is the case for the map, but you're absolutely right, the heyday is gone.
No, you're right. I was speaking at a conference in the summer, and the map, I was walking there, the map told me this was the walking route, and there was a field, there was boulders, there was a gate I had to climb over, and I had to find an alternative way myself. So the digital one was not working out.
I think there's still a lot to be said for the bit of paper.
Well, my thanks to the brilliant Joseph Brady for joining me tonight. The book is called Ireland, Mapping the Island. It's published in hardback by Berlin Limited. The authors are Joseph Brady and Paul Ferguson. And Joe, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Great pleasure as always. Thank you, Patrick.
This autumn sees the launch of Changing Ireland at the National Museum of Ireland at Collins Barracks, the most significant expansion of public galleries in over two decades. The new exhibition showcases objects from the last 150 years that shaped social, political and cultural life on this island, from Rory Gallagher's Fender Stratocaster to Mary Robinson's inauguration suit, a decommissioned IRA rocket launcher and the repeal jumper. And together they tell a vivid story of Ireland in transformation. And to talk to me about this, I'm delighted to be joined by Donal Maguire, Keeper of Art and Industry Collections, and Sandra Heise, Curator of Historical Collections, to explore what visitors can expect and why this marks a new direction for the museum. Well, Donal and Sandra, you're both very welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
So, Donal, let's just begin by how significant this is. This really is a major kind of transformation and expansion, and even a change perhaps in terms of the vision.
Yeah, it's a huge expansion of the site at Collins Barracks. For people who know Collins Barracks, it's a relatively square structure. It's over 350-year-old military barracks. There's three stories to it. And this is the new floor that we're opening is the third floor of the North Block. And it'll be the new home for our 20th and 21st century collections. And this encompasses everything from our history, our cultural collections, our political collections, and everything spanning roughly the last 150 years. It's a huge investment in our national heritage and public access to those collections.
And some of the items, you know, they really do capture the imagination. They really do, sometimes they're striking and startling. For example, the Red Cross flag that covered the body of Michael Collins at Bail na Blore.
Yeah, these are really unique and extraordinary objects and hugely important to what I suppose it means to be Irish, what it means to live in Ireland, and what the whole idea of Ireland is. One of the things that we're trying to do with this display is we're calling it the series of galleries Changing Ireland, but at the heart of it is the objects and the collections. And we're trying to present the objects as actors in history in their own right rather than just illustrative of history, which is a slightly different approach than perhaps the museum has taken to date. And this is the one place in the world you can go to see the actual Red Cross flag that was laid over Michael Collins' body as he was being transported to hospital after his murder.
Sandra, I think it absolutely captures that sense of telling the stories. And I think it's a really imaginative way of, I think, transporting you back in time and really bringing home the power of these stories. And the objects really are really powerful. And how did you decide which ones to include?
Some of the objects have been displayed before, for instance, in the centenary exhibition for the Rising, Proclaiming a Republic in the museum. But here they're being displayed in a different way. So they're being displayed as memory objects and response objects. So, for instance, when you have some of the personal items that belonged to those executed after the Rising, you're not only talking about a political and a military event, you're talking about the knock-on effects for the relatives. So in the Bureau of Military History records are a lot of accounts of people's sisters, mothers, fiancés going in to Kilmainham jail cells before the executions the night before and being given small mementos that just have such intrinsic interest to them, like buttons, razors, straight razors. And in the case of Thomas Clark, his wife, Kathleen, was afterwards sent a sad little set of objects, really. It's a book of stamps, a tiny little pencil stub, and his glasses case, which were just treasured by Kathleen afterwards and kept as sort of like relics. Yeah, so that's what the kind of thing that we have on display. And each object is there to, it's not over-interpreted, but it's the background of the objects are given to sort of give a window into human experiences at the time and what people had to live with after the main event.
But Donal, why bother including a silver-plated tea set that was gifted to Mary Staunton in 1970? You know, why does that matter?
Yeah, I suppose to pick up on what Sandra was saying there, these are the objects that connect with human experience. And I suppose they can act as almost as a means of people reaching back in history and communicating through the object with the people that they connected with. And sometimes these objects are the only source of memory of those experiences from history as well, whether they were 1916 leaders or whether they were Mary Staunton, who was a woman who was forced to leave her work due to the marriage bar. And this was the tea set that was gifted to her on her departure. We do have her diary as well. And she mentioned in her diary that it was the happiest day of her life, and I'm sure it was a very happy day receiving gifts from her colleagues, but it is an important part of history to remember. So there's a very personal story there, but it speaks to a much greater social and cultural story as well. But it's through the objects that people can actually connect with the personal stories behind history. And to speak to something Sandra was saying there as well, the objects are sometimes then the source of memory that are passed on through family members as well and through generations and then passed on to the museum And us as custodians then find ways of connecting our visitors with these objects as well. So it's a real opportunity to put the object. So the tea set is there as a object of memory. It has an object story, it has a material story to it, but it's a way of connecting with real people that are part of the history of Ireland.
I love the tea set because I don't think people visiting the museum will believe it. You know, I struggle to believe it, that for a large part of our history as an independent state, until effectively, I think, you know, Europe really made us change, but that women were forced to resign their jobs in the civil service and in certain parts of work as soon as they got married. Like, it seems so alien and it seems so strange and terrible that you would think this must be 400 years ago and not living memory for people.
And that's the thing, that we're talking about 150 years, so a lot of this is living memory. And right up to the contemporary as well, we've objects representing social, political history from the last decade. But there's a lot of things in this that people will find hard to believe only were there only 20, 30 years ago. Corporal punishment is represented in the displays through a teacher's cane that was actually used to beat children, and a leather strap. And these things, for many young people, I guess, will be interesting parts of history or shocking parts of history in some cases.
Some wonderful clothes, the repeal jumper, Mary Robinson's inauguration suit designed by Louise Kennedy. Also the dress worn by Panty Bliss in that famous, iconic, you know, incredibly powerful oration, the Nobel Call speech from 2014, which really, I suppose, helped kickstart that marriage equality campaign in the public consciousness.
Yeah, and one end of the displays we have Panty Bliss's dress that she wore on the stage of the Abbey Theatre for her Nobel Call speech. On the other end we have the Irish Women Franchise League suffrage banner, and there's a nice kind of folding of history almost between those two objects. Two objects that were part of change in Ireland, but also had agency in themselves. We believe that the dress had as much of a role in who Panty is, her identity, as much as the suffrage banner was in itself a symbol of suffrage and of human rights. And that people looked at these objects as they were part of the story making. They weren't just illustrative. And we've put in a few surprises as well, things people won't expect, where there's a little bit of objects being placed out of history, out of time as well. There's a loose chronology to display, but we've inserted things in different places to create different dialogues and different unexpected juxtapositions in the exhibition as well.
Because sometimes an object captures the historical moment better than text on its own, that sometimes people need to see and feel, and it kind of, it captures the imagination in a way that just words on a page won't.
Absolutely. It's a space for, we want families to come in, multi-generational conversations to happen. And when people enter the galleries, they're going to encounter lots of different faces, recordings of people responding to the collection, talking about the collection, talking about their own experience of Ireland. And this is to open up this, something we're trying to do at the museum, open up this idea of history being a more of a shared space and a shared knowledge, that the museum isn't the owner of history or the owner of this knowledge, that we want to bring these other voices in, bring other perspectives in from across different generations, people of different backgrounds. And that's what people encounter in the space as well, all with the purpose of encouraging people themselves to ask questions and ask, what do I know about this object? What can a grandparent tell their grandchild about this object? Not just what does the curator say about it? So it's a different, and this is all connected in with how I suppose museums are tackling change in the world at the moment, and how we're trying to stay relevant and try out new techniques and new strategies of engaging people.
Sandra, were there certain elements that you were determined to get into to the exhibition?
Very much the suffrage banner, the Irish Women's Franchise League banner, was one that I thought was so evocative and so important to get in, and so delicate as well. It's been conserved in the last 5 or 6 years by Rachel Phelan, the textile conservator, and it always has to be displayed flat. It's behind it is mounted a beautiful image from about 1908, I think, 1906 or 1908, of the banner being held up in Hyde Park at a parade. And Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, one of the founder members of the Irish Women's Franchise League, is standing there proudly with the banner, surrounded by her colleagues and with a lot of the English suffragettes around them as well, suffragists and suffragettes. But so that was one object that I really wanted to get in.
I think it's an absolutely brilliant, imaginative way of telling and retelling the story of our country and a changing Ireland, the National Museum of Ireland at Collins Barracks. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marais O'Sullivan, for bringing everything together. We hope you can join us next week for more debate and discussion. We've been Talking History. Good night.